your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia-cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy, Sean Shapiro. Sean, what's going on, man?
Not too much, bud. I've got my cup of coffee going. Stayed up late watching some hockey last night, and happy to talk more with you. So let's do it.
Well, I'm doing even better. You got a cup of coffee. I got my, and people can't see this. I'll tweet out the picture of it. I've got a Yaroslav Askarov. This is brilliant radio and podcasting material, but I had
Are
to
we
show you. I'm flashing you my Yaroslav Askarov bench press bobblehead that the Milwaukee Admirals did this season after he, of course, did it in his rookie year. And the reason why I'm pointing this out is because you got one from the Admirals, and then you were
Yes.
flaunting it to me in the DMs, rubbing it in, talking about how cool it was. And you know what? This is what good friends are for, because I reached out to our pal Willie Donick, who obviously is one of the best play-by-play guys in the biz for the Predators on Bally, and Predators in town here playing the Canucks. And so we grabbed lunch yesterday, and he sure enough pulls out this Yaroslav Askarov bobblehead, and he's like, "I got something for you." And so I wanted to give him a shout out because he obviously does a phenomenal job, but also because this is one of the coolest bits of promotion and marketing that I think a team's done.
I've got mine on my shelf right over here next to the old like vintage like John Van Beesbrugge goalie mask I bought like a long time as a kid that has stayed with me for forever. So it's I didn't know it was I'm glad I'm doing it in the office today because it's bring your Askarov paraphernalia to work day. I'm glad. And that's one of the greatest like lunch things ever, lunch or beer or whatever you guys are getting when someone says I got something for you. Like that's a prize right there. That's a good one.
It was pretty clutch. I told him he's my favorite. He's my early favorite for Conn Smythe. So we'll obviously see how the rest of the postseason goes. But he's got a leg up on the competition. And speaking of that series, I just wanted a housekeeping note off the top. Apologies for no new show on the feed on Monday following the first weekend of the postseason. If you are in the PDOGAS Discord, you know this by now, but I just wanted everyone to listen to know. I actually recorded a full episode breaking down game one of Canucks Predators with Thomas Drantz on Monday morning. And then after we finished, we found out that the recording hadn't actually gone through. I think we got only 11 minutes of it or so. So we wound up scrapping the abbreviated file. But that's okay. We'll circle back to that series, I'm sure, here shortly. And just like any team that goes through some early postseason lumps, we got to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, bounce back, and redeem ourselves here. So that's what we're going to try to do today. You and I are going to talk about the Stars Golden Knights game one right off the top because it's fresh on our mind. It happened last night. I think it delivered in terms of storylines and drama, and obviously how tight it was being a one goal game. And even when the Golden Knights were up two at various points, it still never felt like the Stars were obviously out of it. Like they were really trading punches back and forth. So we're gonna unpack all of that here. What are your thoughts on that? Because you're now the Red Wings are eliminated, you kind of have the luxury of really covering the Stars again, essentially, which is great for all of us that enjoy your work and want to follow that team. What were your thoughts kind of in that game, how it played out, what the vibe should be like exiting game one and entering game two of the rest of the series?
So, fun fact, it's funny that you talked about the Predators earlier. The Stars haven't won a true game one of a playoff series in front of fans since 2019 in Nashville against Nashville. They won game ones in the bubble in COVID, but the Stars between Rick Bonus, Pete DeBoer, I guess Jim Montgomery did win a home, but like this, it's funny. It's kind of baked into the Stars' DNA that every single series in the past couple of years, they're always down 0-1 in the series. So I don't know why we should have expected anything else, I guess. But for me, this was kind of one of those weird games where like I'm hearing the broadcast and they're talking all about Vegas playing Vegas hockey and everything like that. And to an extent, Vegas was, but you can't tell me that Vegas hockey is 15 shots on goal. You can't tell me that Vegas hockey is getting your game-winning goal on a fluky one that either deflects or screens off of Miro Heiskanen and Jake Oettinger. So to me, it was a game where like I thought Dallas was the better team. I thought Vegas had its three moments it needed. And then basically just went to like old man beer league hockey style where we'll just keep you to the outside and we don't really need to move our legs right now. That's kind of what it felt like to me.
Yeah, that's certainly what it felt like to me too. I It's tough to know, right? Because they came out, Vegas came out of the gate looking much faster than I expected them to in this series, and maybe even faster than Dallas expected them to. They almost caught off guard with how much speed they were flying through the neutral zone with. I had the final, like, I had Vegas with 11 scoring chances for the game. We'll get into how many Dallas had in a second. Five on five, I should say. Vegas had 11 scoring chances. I'd wager, I don't have it in front of me, I'd wager 7 or 8 of them were in the first period. Like, they came out hot. They had a bunch of scoring chances. They actually did look like that was Vegas hockey because they were like quickly turning sort of 50-50 pucks in the neutral zone into 3-on-2 rush chances, even after the first goal, I think. Eichel gets a puck like off the wall at center ice right off the draw. And all of a sudden they have another 3-on-2 opportunity and they get a rush chance out of it. And that's kind of scary. That's when they're at their scariest. We didn't see that the rest of the way. I would say, though, that defensively, it did look like Vegas hockey. And the reason why I note that is they were the team that conceded the fewest number of inner slot shots this season. And we've spoken at length about how that's by design. In this game, shot attempts were 68 to 48 Dallas, shots on goal 30 to 15. But at 5-on-5, I had Dallas with just 10 scoring chances of their own. And that's in 52 and a half minutes of game time. And this is a Stars team that generates scoring chances in a variety of ways in high volume. They live in that high danger area, and they weren't really able to get in there for pretty much any extended period of this game. And so I thought there was a bunch of things that Vegas did defensively that actually would concern me from a Stars perspective. But obviously, in totality, when you view the game, I think there's a lot to build on if you're Pete DeBoer right now, because it's like, all right, well, if we keep playing this way for the rest of the series, we have to feel good about our chances, because you're right. Vegas sort of got that lead and then was just white knuckling it essentially through the finish line.
There's certain things where if you're Dallas, you go through and you got to assess and figure out how you get back to the slot. How do you start getting some of those second pucks that you used to basically get all season that you're not getting? And I think that's definitely a concern for Dallas. It's for me though, kind of the bigger thing that was just Vegas's first period, obviously had the chance, as you said, what, 7 or 8 scoring chances in the first period. Something similar around that too. From the rest of the way, like, and maybe it's, I don't know if I'm lying to myself and it's the narrative of it's Vegas, but like, I remember watching them, Vegas in the playoffs last year, right? And the team had the, they didn't really do the bunker down thing. They had the, they ripped you apart. Like they weren't the, they didn't play with their food. They just ripped you apart. And it's to see Vegas kind of just, maybe that's a testament to Dallas pushing back. Maybe it was the, you get all these guys off injured reserve, get return, and they hit the dead sprint and they gotta have hit a slight jog in the second period. Maybe it's that. But to me, it wasn't the, like, anyone going through and saying, like, oh, this is the Vegas team that won the cup last year. Like, the Vegas team that won the cup last year, to me, they ripped teams apart. They didn't play with their food. And this Vegas team kind of played with their food until Dallas got back into it and picked to prod it a little bit. And obviously some help from pretty howler of a goal by the Marchman
Marchment.
goal
Yep.
was, yeah. So.
Well, I guess the reason why I framed it as I'm not sure is because I can, like, that's unequivocally correct what you just said. I'm just not sure how much of it was this being a team that clearly showed it still has some semblance of that juice you're describing from last season, based on the first 10 minutes they played in this game, where they like almost showed you, like, yeah, we still got our fastball. And then when it faded as the game went along, how much of that was sort of this general concept of score effects, them realizing that they had a lead and they were just going to try to milk this through to the finish line, and how much of it was the reality that they actually can't sustain that for a full game for a variety of reasons. Should also note, and part of this kind of factors into your framing of this series, this is like the first game that this team has essentially played together, right? And in particular, like, you're watching Hertl and Stone interact, and for a hockey nerd like you and I, it's incredibly fascinating to sort of see that. But Stone certainly, as you'd expect, looked rusty and probably not anywhere near 100% throughout the course of that game. And how much of that is a thing where that's just going to be the reality for this team for the rest of this postseason, and how much of it is something that you can sort of work into as these games go along, hopefully for them, in the sense that you establish some rhythm and some continuity and chemistry and figure that all out. And then guys just start feeling better about their game. And all of a sudden by round two or three, if they make it that far, they're in their fully kind of realized form, as opposed to whatever this version is, which is clearly like still trying to figure out what it should look like.
Well, yeah. Like Stone and Hurdle, I think, is a perfect example where last night their chances and the goals that the two of them were a part of, right? It's two of their basic instincts on things that you don't need quote unquote chemistry. Hurdle goes to the front of the net. He's big. Stars need to do better. I mean, Esa Lindell got completely out positioned on that. That's something Dallas probably has to look at there. Maybe you switch something up with in the back end, but maybe you have a Tanev go there a little bit more. I don't know. And then, and Stone did a good job of creating a little bit of havoc in the slot and got the tip. That's kind of their basic instinct thing. That's not a, that doesn't tell me that at 5-on-5, these two guys are going to click. At 5-on-5, this is a line that I think they can click. Like, I think if you give these guys 4 or 5 more games, like even by game 6 or 7 of this series, Stone and Hurdle could be a very scary pairing together as a line. But right now it's the whole, like, I don't know what they'll look like. I don't know what their tendencies will be. It's really, you mentioned kind of the hockey nerds like us who watch this. I'm fascinated just to watch that line again closely. Like, it was the, like, I know we were messaging this morning before we came on air. Like, I know you went back and rewatched most of the game. I rewatched some of it. I intentionally went and watched some of the shifts that they played, and it's, you can see little things here and there, but it's still two guys that have never effectively been on the ice together in a real moment. And that's both a benefit in the short term right now for Dallas and a scary thing in the long run for everyone else if Vegas gets by Dallas.
Well, especially what's interesting about them is in contrast to their other star line with Eichel, Marchessault, and Barbashev, you saw them, exactly why they're so dangerous in game one off the rush and the goal they created and a few other chances that they had along the way. And they're just, the dichotomy between those two in terms of how they're going to beat you is so interesting to me, because one is clearly just so rush oriented. And you're certainly going to get, especially with Stevenson playing with those two other guys, you're going to get some rush looks for them off the stone, turnovers created and everything. But they're going to just essentially try to ground and pound you and like old man game around the net, which is how they created the two power play goals they did. And so I do like that kind of idea where they're just so different in that way. And they're each going to provide clear utility at their best, but it's going to be in wildly different ways. And that's what makes it such a compelling matchup, because we spend so much time in the lead up to it praising Dallas for having this versatility and depth of weapons. Yeah. And then now we're saying that exact same thing about their round one opponent, which makes this so overqualified to be a first round series.
It's what makes playoff hockey great, right? Like what you and I have talked about it before, where playoff hockey is not the, it gets more physical. It's not the, like, yes, it gets semi more physical, but one of the reasons playoff hockey gets more physical is because 82 game season, everything is, you're playing, you're only focused on yourself. That's the reality as a coach. You only focus on yourself. You could have a back to back. You could have a, you could have a 3-4. You could have, sorry, not a 3-4 anymore. You could have a 2-3. You have all of these things. You're only focused on yourself. And then you get to the postseason and okay, now you can turn your focus and gaze to be like, okay, I now get to worry about what the other guy does. I get to actually turn this into a true chess match. You can make some adjustments in the regular season, but in the reality, it's not something you're implementing in practice in a morning skate. It's just, I focus on my guys. Playoffs, you start to know what everyone does. By end of Vegas and Dallas already know exactly what they're going to do. And I think one of the things that is exciting about this is at the same time, there's a bit of a wild card in it, right? With, we don't know what Hurdle and Stone and that line is really going to look like. We get a little bit of an idea. We can kind of speculate, as you pointed there, and take some evidence from that. But it's one of those things where we're going to kind of learn something we don't know about two teams that we know almost everything else about them coming into this. That makes this kind of fun. So I think, well, I made a good point.
No, you made a great point there. And let me build off that. What makes this matchup so fun for me and why I can't wait to see it play out? And I actually thought the broadcast, you know, ESPN gets a lot of criticism for its broadcast and its commentary and like how it frames a lot of this stuff. I actually really thought they did a good job throughout this game of kind of highlighting what was happening in Ryan Callahan in particular. And as you went along, it brought us back to this point that we've discussed on here that you wrote about, and that's why I want to get into that with you, is Vegas this year was third in an NHL in block shots. They averaged about 18 of them per 60 minutes of play. In game one, they blocked another 20. And this isn't one of those things where it's like a team just kind of chasing the puck, and because they're so overmatched, what, like throwing their body in harm's way and then blocking a bunch of them, but then the other team just turning that into scoring chances anyways. This is very deliberate and by design on their part, where they, in their zone scheme, they force you to the outside. They have a bunch of big dudes who essentially just stand around the net and they block shots. And what makes them uniquely equipped, I think, to frustrate and challenge Dallas's offense, in particular their top line, and you saw a lot of that in game one, is that sort of aggressive fronting that they do in the defensive zone essentially eliminates, unless, you know, the puck just gets by him or has a random bounce, and that can happen. That essentially happened on that Hurdle goal where he beat Lindell, certainly, but Lindell was in front of him. The puck just got past him, and then Hurdle was alone. So that can happen for the Stars as well. But in game one, you saw a lot of situations where they're sort of trying to set themselves up and position themselves to work that high-low tip play that they love to incorporate in their game. And Vegas was just essentially snuffing every single one of those out by fronting the guy, taking away the stick, and just blocking it, and then immediately getting it out of the zone. And so what that did was, not only did it eliminate Dallas's primary source of offense from that top line when they're not attacking off the rush, it's those tip plays, but it also then eliminated extended zone time for the Stars because it killed those possessions and got it out of the zone. And so that would be concerning for me from a Stars perspective, because you have to find a workaround for that if you're going to win this series, because you just need more from Hintz, Robertson, and Pavelski. Robertson got the goal, of course. That was off of a shift where he was out there with Stankoven, and Stankoven did the heavy lifting and he scored off the rush. They didn't get anything else in that game at 5-on-5, the three of those when they were out there. And so that's something that you're in this off day, if you're Pete DeBoer, like, that's something that I'm thinking about above all else, I think.
And you look at, like, you watch that game, right? It was, if obviously, if any if any franchise has a history where they dislike Joe Pavelski, it's Vegas, obviously, which is well known for other reasons. The you watched that game last night, and the way there was almost like it almost seemed like there was a bit of like the internal memo of when Pavelski goes to the slot, you tie him up more than anyone else. It just kind of seemed like that, right? And I don't know if it's something that I was looking for. I don't know if it's something that was actually said by Bruce Cassidy internally. I have no idea. But just watching the game, it looked to me like Pavelski was it was more and more of Vegas, like, okay, Joe Pavelski is not going to beat us at what Joe Pavelski does. And they took him out of the game. They basically took him out of the game that way. And Hintz, to me, is the guy who, if there's a quote unquote concern with that line, he's the guy who I would have liked to. We've seen times before where Roope Hintz like jumps in and just takes over games, right? Like, how many times do we watch him fly in and it's one of like the greatest dopamine rushes in the world, right? Like watching Roope Hintz get up and go and it's amazing. And last night to me was one of those games from a Hintz perspective where that version of Roope Hintz could have unlocked a lot and it never showed up. And I know Roope Hintz plays through a ton of injuries. He's a guy, he's kind of the classic example of we'll probably never see him play 82 games because of what he does to his body to be that fast and to go and it's his healing time and everything. But that's what to me, for that line, like you needed Hintz to be that guy to start unlocking some other things because Pavelski's game in the offensive zone particularly, it is so tied to what others do many times, right? So
Well, I thought, you know, you could see Hintz flying through the neutral zone and setting stuff up off of entries a couple times as
couple
the game went
times,
along. And
but
in fact, even with, like, I think, what, with like 10, 15 seconds left, right? He kind of had a nice little entry there, set up a Jamie Benn shot. And that was that kind of that one last little push they had. The concern for me is that you haven't really seen that trademark him flying into the zone, Roope Hintz Gobert shot, where he just rips one past the goalie. And you're like, that was the most electric play in hockey. And even when you look at, like, however many goals he scored this year, I think you have to go back to like January to find the last time that he actually just walked into a shot and just cleanly beat a goalie. Like, he's compensated for that by doing a lot of dirty work, kind of hovering around the net, tipping pucks in, getting rebounds, getting greasy ones. And that's good because those count the same. But to your point, in this series, you actually need him to do that one thing that separates him from everyone else on the ice, which is just that physical ability to take the puck, weave through traffic, and beat the goalie. And they are going to need that. I wonder if, you know, it's dangerous to play because Vegas is so good at like knocking pucks down and keeping pucks in and turning the puck over in the neutral zone. But I wonder if you don't like you kind of saw it with the Benn goal where he kind of flies the zone, Wyatt Johnson wins a battle, and they get a breakaway goal out of it. I'd be tempted to have Hintz cheat a little bit in this series to try and just fly the zone and see if you can catch Vegas flat-footed or even force them to kind of compensate by then sagging back themselves defensively. Because otherwise, it's going to be hard against this team once they're in a position already for them to create the way they'd like, you know, barring that sort of outcome. So I think that's interesting. Let me give you a few stats on that to kind of reinforce this point. So Roope Hintz played 14 5-on-5 minutes in game one. About seven of it was against the McNabb-Theodore pairing. In that time, the Stars attempted eight shots. They got one of them through traffic and onto the net, and they wound up with a 17% expected goal share in that time. And I think McNabb had like six or seven block shots himself in the game. And they did a really good job, I thought, of exactly what we illustrated there, which is taking away Pavelski and blocking shots and then preventing them from executing that way against every other defense pair. 7 minutes, they had four attempts, four of them made it on goal. And so I'm not saying that, like, because we're talking about a Hanifin Petrangelo pairing here. So I'm not saying that, like, McNabb and Theodore is this destructive force that is going to totally dictate this series. But in this case, McNabb is so good at blocking shots like this, similar to Alec Martinez, who they scratched for this game. And that gave them problems. And so they're going to have to find a workaround to that because I don't think they can just rely on Wyatt Johnson's line and other means of offense. Like, they need this top line to be much better than it was in game one.
No, 100% on that. It's the other thing too about it was like you look at kind of Dallas and how they kind of that line also tends to build off its power play often at times where it's just like momentum, emotional, whatever terminology you want to use too. They really didn't get much done there either. So it was the, I mean, I think the Dallas total had what, four shots on the power play last night. There was opportunities kind of blown there as well from that line to kind of build on it. And I don't, they need to be better. It's the classic, as my good friend Bob Sturm says, you need your best players to be your best players sometimes, and they weren't your best players.
No, they weren't. And part of that is like, and we talked about this, but there's no, I can't think of many extended shifts where they just spent it in the offensive zone. And this is a team that was top 10 in the league at cycling, just beyond the rush itself. Like, they're really good at hemming you in and building on chances that way. And Vegas did such a good job. And Callahan noted this as well, of like, whenever the puck would come on the wall, Vegas would just like be quick on sending multiple guys there, having support and instantly getting it out. And Dallas seemed almost like befuddled by the fact that they were just beating them to all those battles. So I'm not sure if that's something that's a real thing is going to continue. And it was just a one game thing, but I don't know. What I find it so fascinating because, as we said, like, Vegas started off so well and then sagged back, and the final count of all this stuff looks like it's in Dallas's favor. And they certainly look like the superior team, but then just how do we parse how much of that was by design from Vegas and how much of it was something that just can't continue? Because I came away from it, I posted in Discord being like, if I'm the Stars, I feel good about that process. But also in the playoffs, there's not that much room for moral victories because you lose three more of these games out of the next six, and then you're spending the summer wondering what happened. And so that's the trick, kind of slippery slope.
And that's the other key thing about Dallas too, right? You look at, and it's a weird game too for your goalie perspective too, right? Where like if I gave you just the goals against in that first period against Jake Ottinger, you're not really like okay, that's a tip, that's a tip, that's a one-timer on the rush, and then another tip. Like it's the whole thing. It's like okay, but you can't let up three goals on 10 shots in the first period of a playoff game. You can't go what a 733 save percentage in a playoff game. It's kind of the weird thing from a Dallas perspective where you look at that game too, where if you get a save on one of those, it doesn't even matter which one. If you get one of those saves, you're at a game where if the game plays out the same way, you're probably winning. It's a very odd game to open the series in many ways for me, because there's all these elements where it just added more questions than answers. It's like, okay, was Jake Ottinger good or bad? Well, is the what is Stone? What are Stone and Hurdle? Well, like, there's a lot of those additional like questions that moved on, which is great. And like, it's why I hope we get seven of these, because it'll be fun, because we get actual true answers. But that's, I don't know the answer on all these questions.
Well, and also, like, I would lean towards it have being partly by design and Vegas being willing to let them have what they had because they felt like they could get to the finish line. And this is a team that won the Stanley Cup last year and is like a very veteran group. And I actually do think there is something to this idea that like you kind of know your how much you have to do to get the job done on a given night for when you reach a certain status as a team. And so I'm willing to subscribe to that. The issue is that I subscribed to it with Tampa Bay in the past, and then you watch that round one series against the Leafs last year, and they blew a bunch of games late in overtime
Yeah.
where they lost. And it's like, all right, well, this is a former Stanley Cup champion that knows how to
Yeah.
quote unquote win these games until they don't. And that's what's so fun about all of these playoff narratives is that you can paint any picture you want and it can be true until it isn't. And then the opposite is true. And so we'll see kind of how we'll need to see more from the series to know. Get a true, I guess, litmus test for what game one really represented, but it gave
Yeah.
us at least enough to, I think, like get us motivated for the rest of the series and get excited about it. Let's take a quick break here, Sean. And then when we come back, I've got a few other notes on this, and then we can kind of bounce around the rest of the league and all the stuff we saw on Monday night. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hey, it's Dan Riccio
and Satyar Shah.
Join us for Canucks Central, where we will set up the game and break down the latest around the Canucks.
4 to 6 p.m. and post-game on Sportsnet 650 and wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back here on the Hockey PDOcast with Sean Shapiro. Sean, we're talking Stars, Golden Knights from Monday night's game one. What other notes did you have from this game? Because I know you wrote up a bunch of stuff about it. We've hammered Vegas's defensive structure already against Dallas's offense. What else caught your eye?
One of the interesting things to me was how Dallas elected to start this game. I just kind of that's was we know Vegas starts. Bruce Cassidy has made it pretty clear throughout the regular season. I mean, I don't know if it's every single period, but almost it feels like every Vegas game I've watched, and unless they're on somewhere on special teams, Cassidy rolls out that fourth line that goes out and they start the fourth line and they start the game that way. And Dallas decided to match it by rolling their fourth line with Steele, Fox, and Dadonov, and it effectively led to a penalty against Steele 26 seconds into the game, and ultimately Stone's power play goal. And to me, that was an interesting decision by Pete DeBoer, because I know DeBoer is not a line matcher; he's a line roller. I know that. And so, with that in mind, it was odd for me when you get the chance as the home team to set your line and everything like that, that you go with that line and basically decide we're going to roll the same as them. Like that to me was an interesting choice by Pete DeBoer. And I personally would have said, okay, I mean, obviously it's easy to look at it with hindsight being 2020. Like, why wouldn't you have started the Stankoven Johnston Benn line, or maybe the Pavelski line? It's one of those things that, just as a knowing Pete DeBoer's philosophy on I'm going to roll lines this way and everything like that, I don't understand why he played into Vegas's hands off the opening faceoff. That was an interesting thing by me.
Especially when it's kind of cheating to say that it's technically their fourth line on the depth chart, but if Nick Waugh is anchoring it, it's not a
Yeah,
fourth
yeah,
line.
yeah.
Like
Yes. Yeah, 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 yeah.
that's a second line for a lot of
Yeah.
teams. So
And not only that too, but a fourth line that was just had never played together before, right? Like, I mean, not never, like, did with they took out Craig Smith, they brought in Dadonov to play. Dadonov had been out until for like the last 21 games or whatever, until game 82 when he came back in for Sagan. So you put a line out there for its first like live bullets shift is against a line that is literally, we know what they do. Everyone in the building knows what they do. So like, that to me was a coaching head scratcher for me from the way Pete DeBoer handled that. And normally it doesn't hurt you, but it led to the Steele penalty. It led to the goal against. These are the things that kind of in these microcosms of these series with the millimeters of differences, right? That's a difference.
Yeah, I know. In the playoffs, every single one of these little edges gets highlighted, and I'm with you. I think it's kind of a no-brainer to start games just in general with the Johnston Stankoven combo because they're just so
Yes.
likely to win a battle right off the top. And then I just immediately send out hints to hope that he can catch the other team off guard with a rush chance. But this isn't NFL. We aren't scripting plays
Yes.
here to start the game with. It's obviously much more free-flowing and nuanced. But
Yeah.
yeah, I'm with you. That obviously bit them. And that was kind of the story of this game as well, where it was just like a series of kind of backbreakers for Dallas where they never really were able to get going because they're down right away. And it's Mark Stone, of all people, who scores it in his return. Then they're down 2-0. They get the goal, but it's called off of on an offside review. It just kind of back and forth. They never were able to get it going. Do you have any stuff on the goaltending? Because you kind of noted Ottinger. I actually
Yeah.
thought that, Thompson's made the saves at the end that he needed
Oh,
to,
yeah.
and his save percentage looks fine. I thought even like obviously the Marchand one where he flubs it looks
Yeah.
horrible. I thought he looked very shaky
I
regardless
agree.
throughout. And there was one shot I noticed with like 5 minutes left in the game, maybe. And it was kind of like an innocuous Harley shot from the left side, kind of like at a bad angle just above the circle. And Thompson just like made a meal of trying to corral it. And it wound up to a re wound up being a rebound and they didn't score. But just watching that, it's like, I know that both him and Hill were kind of thought of to be pretty banged up physically heading into this series. And I thought you could kind of see that in this game where wound up getting the job done. But if I'm Dallas, I'm just testing him as much as I can because even the saves he made didn't necessarily pass my eye test.
To me, that was one of my biggest disagreements, which with the ESPN broadcast last night, where I think there was some point the line where they're talking about they're like, oh, he's recovered well from that Marchment one. And it was like a play where it was a not a that it shouldn't have been that dangerous of a shot, and he made it look more difficult. To me, that would be one of my huge takeaways from a Dallas perspective. I imagine part of, and obviously every team goes through and they break down goalie charts and everything like that, but I'm sure one of the things that the Stars will be taking into game two as well is you just gotta shoot on them right now. Like that's like I get that feeling about both Vegas goalies, having watched some of both of their games kind of down the stretch, and then obviously watching Thompson last night. It was like Thompson had a couple of those like weird big saves where you're like, okay, you battled to get there,
Right.
but at the same time you're like, this is not a sustainable formula for success with the way the save selection is being made here, with where you are. If Vegas is not doing as good of a job as they are, is kind of creating that halo around the crease, there's a couple where Dallas has been a team is just banging home rebounds for goals that he kind of got away with too. So yeah, they said that on the broadcast, like, oh, he responded well. I don't think he ever responded well. I think he made a couple good scrambly saves with because of his athleticism, but the form and function were highly concerning, I'm sure, for Vegas when Sean Burke, their goalie coach, is going through everything today.
Yeah, he was battling himself more than the star shots, it felt like. So, yeah, that's something certainly to watch as the series goes along. I also thought I had a note that particularly early on, it kind of lessened as the game went along, but Vegas seemed to be making like a concerted effort of just absolutely unloading on the forecheck on Harley in particular. I was like, man, they're really just targeting him here. And he had a rough stretch to start with a few kind of 50-50 pucks or giveaways that I think were a direct result of that. I thought he really found his footing as the game went along. And in fact, there were a few plays where like he would jump in on the rush and be either the third man in or leading it. And the puck just awkwardly bounced off of someone's stick and nothing came of it, but it very easily could have been a highlight reel goal. And so I thought it was impressive that he bounced back the way he did in that game under those circumstances. But that's something to watch because we made so much of last year's series between these two teams where Miro had no help, and Vegas made a point of just attacking him off the forecheck and wearing him down over the course of those six games. And now I'm curious to see how that unfolds in this series. And obviously, Dallas has more options in terms of their defensive depth and talent to deal with it. But it is also, it just kind of highlights, we're talking about the differences between regular season and postseason. I think like the functional physicality in this sense of what a nightmare it is to be a top defenseman against good forechecking teams gets highlighted because I imagine there's this psychological accumulation beyond all the physical pain of just knowing that the same guys are going to be turning the corner and just trying to just nail you into the boards every single time you go back to play a puck.
It's the first time also from an emotional perspective too. It's the first time Thomas Harley has come in and the entire world now knows who Thomas Harley is. Like, I feel like you and I, there's people who watched that series last year and we all gushed about where he was going and everything like that, but he was still the kid called up from Texas who really was solving other people's problems. Now, when Vegas goes into their locker room and everything like that, and they got their whiteboard up with names, it's they circle 55, go hit 55, right? That's the type of thing that comes with growth in the NHL, right? It's the classic example of, I like to use the terminology of it, and it's not my original terminology at all, but you learn the league and the league learns you at the same time, right? And so Thomas Harley, there's now a book on Thomas Harley. There's now a plan of attack that other teams make at you. And I think this is the first, this is going to be a really fascinating growth perspective for me for Harley, where he's a guy who's always been incredibly cocky, always had that swagger and ego and everything like that. And this is kind of the first time I think he's really going to be tested that way by a world-class opponent. Like, obviously, he played junior hockey. People said, oh, go hit him. He was bigger and could skate faster than everyone else. All that stuff. Like, it's going to be, from Harley's growth and perspective, this is another fascinating subplot in this series. And I thought he performed better as the game went along. Not nearly as good as he's been all year, but I thought he settled a little bit.
No, he did. My one final note on this is I just thought that, I mean, obviously Johnston, Benn, and Stankoven were Dallas's best trio, and they created a ton of chances. Stankoven turning the tables on Mark Stone at the end of the first was a delight. And I say that as someone who has enjoyed Mark Stone victimizing people with that exact play for years now. And so just seeing the tables turn on him like that was very cool. And Stankoven's awesome. And he just continues to be a nightmare, particularly on that back check where he just gets on his horse and just attacks you and creates so much destruction and dysfunction.
His leverage point is incredible. Like, it's one thing you obviously expect him to have he has to have a lower center of gravity when you're probably actually 5'7", 5'6". You have to have a low point of gravity, but he plays it so well. Like, there's so many times where he'll be on the forecheck or in the corner battle, right, where against a much bigger guy, and you'll almost kind of see that shock in their face of like, wait, this guy's way more dense than I ever expected him to be. So
dense is a good word.
Yes.
He's a very dense young lad. Yes. Yeah, these West games have been awesome. I mean, I'm obviously enjoying the entire postseason, but I was also noting to you, like, just the pace or competitiveness at times of these West games compared to some of the East ones. It does seem like it's wildly different to me, but looking forward to watching both because all these games are awesome and round one is just the best. Do you want to do are we done with this series? Do you have any other notes? Do you want to kind of bounce around the league and do some spark notes, I guess?
Yeah, let's bounce around a bit.
Let's do some spark notes of the other series that played on Monday. It's always tough covering this stuff in real time and in the playoffs, right? Because I don't want to be talking about games that are happening tonight, because by the time people listen, everyone listens at different times to the show.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it's completely outdated. So I'm trying to like talk about games during their days off, so we actually give people time to consume and process and think about this stuff. So let's talk about the games on Monday. Quick in order, Canes, Isles. Shot attempts were 110-28 for Carolina. And after the Islanders went up 3-0 early in the second, shots on goal were 29-3 for Carolina the rest of the way. The two goals scored 9 seconds apart to take the lead. I guess you could look at this two ways, right? Because obviously Carolina is just a vastly superior team to their opponent in this matchup. Yeah. On the one hand, you could be like, oh, here we go again. This is such a classic Canes playoff performance where the shot attempts are 110-28 and they had to essentially pull victory from the jaws of defeat. On the other hand, if you're optimistic about this Hurricanes team the way I am this year, you view it as like, well, this is why it's different, because they actually found a way to break through and take a game like this, as opposed to being on the wrong end of it where everyone's screenshotting the shots on goal disparity and laughing about how they essentially did the same thing over again.
To me, it's the body blows are paying off for Carolina now. And it's the, obviously, like, the Martinuk goal, right? It is, I'm sure there was a question in the, I'm sure Patrick Waugh had a question for his goaltender of how and why he decided to play it that way, but it's one of those mistakes, right? That you probably don't make that mistake in the first period. You don't make that mistake as a defenseman in the first period and second period. But when we talked about the emotional level of just getting hammered over and over again, first 5, 10 times, you can take it. The 35th time you get plastered into the boards, you start to coil up a bit. And every like to me, it's last night was a perfect example of how the body blows Carolina throws, to use a boxing analogy, can lead to that knockout that doesn't look like a knockout, but really you kind of laid the groundwork for it 15 shots earlier. And I think that's kind of how I look at what Carolina did. And I don't know, I'm bullish on Carolina too. Like I picked them to be in the final. I think it's a, I think they're going to take chunks out of teams. And sometimes in the long run, you might not get the goal early on, but I think it's gonna leave some damage. So that's how I look at Carolina right now.
So I wanted to note this. I'm not sure if I mentioned it during my my two-part playoff preview last week. I did it with Jack Fraser and Jack Hahn, and it was absolute mayhem. We were trying to cover everything, and things were flying all over the place as I was trying to lead the conversation with two Jacks at that. So I was like
Oh
trying to
man. Oh
reference who I
man.
was talking to. It was a whole ordeal. I think it turned out well though. But I don't know if I noted at the time that Seth Jarvis was my favorite Conn Smythe pick this season. Now I don't bet on hockey, but if you want to enjoy the postseason and do so responsibly, I think it's like I saw him at like plus 14,000 or something to win the Conn Smythe. And now who knows with Carolina, because they have so many options if they go on a long run, right? There's so many good players there that you can build a narrative around. But I just think he's on the top line, top unit power play. He's a good bet to be their leading scorer. And you watch that game, it does feel like he's kind of like the emotional like energy for this team as well, right? Like he scores that goal, he gets them going. And so I think he's such an awesome player, but I kind of wanted to shout that out. Let's do Leafs Bruins. So I want to talk to you about the goalie decision, because obviously you and I have spoken about our pal Monty in the past and the way he's handled this. In particular, a lot was made of last postseason when a lot of people felt like he mishandled it. Now, Swayman plays remarkably well in game one, stops 35 of 36. They go to Allmark in game two. I know they lost the game. Allmark played well. And I will say, even regardless of the result, like heading into it, I felt like I'm okay with it. Like, I think Swayman is clearly the superior goalie of the two. But if there was ever a time you were going to do this, I felt like doing it for game two was the right move. Because if you didn't, then it would be really tough to justify later in the postseason, in my opinion.
I have no issue with it. I personally think, like, because they've alternated every single start since February. It's the formula that's worked. Swayman played what? Pull it up. Swayman started 43 this year. Ullmark started 39. I personally would keep rotating them until you got to the point where it was like, okay, now we roll with Swayman the rest of the way. Like, that's the way I would do it. I think part of the Vegas story last year, part of the Florida story, the Bobrovsky run last year, is I think we see more and more how physically taxing the position has become. And if you're gonna win a Stanley Cup, I think I always kind of circle the number as you need your goalie to be not pushing further than 70 games. And if a guy's gonna play, like even Swayman, right? Like he only started 43 this year, but say Boston was to go all the way to the final and everything like that, and they played 23, 24 games, whatever it was, you'd be pushing right around 70 if you played every game. Like to me, I have no issue with the rotating goalie thing, especially in round one, especially in round two. We saw Carolina did it last year, and that when they had the super long playoff, like it can be a tool at times. And I would keep doing it right now. And unless one guy gives you a reason to take himself out of the rotation, I would not change it. That's my personal view on it. Now, I'm sure some people disagree and everything like that, but that's my personal take on it for now.
Well, not only are that splits of a game started, but I believe that the stat is that they had alternated starts 27 straight times up until this point. And so, like, if you're using the regular season as kind of a trial run to essentially prepare yourself for the playoffs, you can't really switch it at this
No,
point, in my
no.
opinion, because you just haven't, like, I'm sure there's a day off between games. It's not a back to back necessarily, but the preparation that goes into getting yourself ready for starts is matters, in my opinion. That's something we don't account for. And so throughout the regular season, if you're Jeremy Swayman or Linus Allmark and you know, all right, I'm playing tonight, that means that 2 days from now I'm not playing. The way you prepare yourself and how you go about your business is going to be different than if you're just a workhorse starter who's starting every one of those games. And so that's the way you've gone all season. I think that would be very dramatic change at this point. The bigger issue for me is that they had one scoring chance in the third period in a tie game. And so Allmark was good. He did everything he needed to. They just offensively, that was the bigger concern for me. I thought the Leafs did a much, like, in game one, their defense was exposed, in my opinion, with the lack of puck moving ability, because they've prioritized having these big, tough defensive defensemen this year, and they just could not get out of their zone to save their life. Their forwards did a way better job of coming low to support them in game two. And shout out Auston Matthews, who delivered just an absolute monster performance. He played 23-24, which was actually the most in the team, even more than any other defenseman. They scored three goals. He had primary assists in the first two, then the cool game winner off the alley-oop in the third. He helps keep the puck out during that late scramble when it's loose. Eight scoring chances, set up two more, 12 shot attempts, and he did it all against Lindholm, Carlo, and McAvoy. And I guess as this series goes to Toronto, assuming Willie Nylander is going to be back here at some point, that's going to be a big deal, because Boston's very careful about how they're using their depth defensemen. And all of a sudden, if they're going to be using all these guys against Matthews, eventually they're just going to have to use someone else against Nylander, and that seems like it could be a massive advantage for the Leafs. So I don't think that storyline is, like, it's been talked about because it's the Leafs and it's Willie Nylander, and so everyone's aware of it, I guess. But, like, the actual practical ramifications of what it'll do to the series could really blow this open, I think.
Well, on top of that too, right? Wasn't there there's the injury to Peak today too, so you're going deeper into Boston's depth as well. So, yeah, it's one of those like chess matches where the matchup part is going to be it's going to be interesting when it goes to Toronto. If Boston was going to be a truly buy into the things you and I beliefs, they wouldn't be dressing Ullmark at all in game three, and they would give him the complete day off, and they would be having the other guy. And that's now if we want to go fully down our perfect world for hockey using our old if the what's the image there? That's like if everything was like this, so that would be that way. But we're not getting that, unfortunately.
No, we won't. Well, I mean, also, like, in case, if, God forbid, Swayman gets hurt or something, I think you do want to have Allmark ready to go and not chilling in the hotel room. Okay, Oilers Kings is the last one. I thought, the Oilers wind up with seven goals. I thought the Kings were lucky that it was that low. McDavid had five assists in. I thought that was a low range of outcomes for him, because how much he created, I thought he very easily could have had seven or eight, if not more. And just watching the way he was carving through them, in particular, like, 3-5-on-5 goals against Philip Deneau, which is a head-to-head matchup that Deneau has held his own in previously. He had Mikey Anderson just in the torture chamber all night whenever he was out there against him. And the fastball the Oilers just threw at them, like, it's a long series. I'm sure the Kings are going to find a way to kind of claw back into it and be more respectable. But the past two versions of this were so close and hard fought, and then the Oilers finally found a way to win at the end with their talent level. In this case, it just looked so one-sided, and I just thought, like, the offensive creation that they displayed was staggering. I mean, I've been tracking all these games. We started recording, so I didn't have a chance to finish this one, but I had the Oilers with 14 scoring chances in the first period alone. That's more than Dallas and Vegas had all of their game yesterday. So I think they're going to get into the 30s by the time I'm done tracking that. And just, it's staggering what they did to the Kings, who, for all their flaws, are a stingy defensive team.
I was amazed when I looked at McDavid's time on ice that it was only 1847. Like it was one of those where you're watching the game and now I had both screens going, so I had the Dallas game on the one and I was kind of flipping back and forth and everything like that. But it was one of those kind of games where you're like, oh man, McDavid is just killing them. He's playing he must be at like 26 minutes tonight. And then you look and he's like 1847. And it was one of those where it's like, oh man, and this isn't even putting in the extra time. This is just done that way. One of my biggest flaws in my prediction preview was I was like, oh, I thought like I took the emotional look where I'm like, yeah, it's really hard to beat a team 3 years in a row. Like that's what I kind of
Oh my God, you didn't pick the Kings, did you?
I did, unfortunately. I was trying to be I tried to be sneakily smart on it, and I'm looking very stupid on it. It was incredibly stupid. I'm willing to admit that already, even after one game.
Oh man, I unfortunately watched a lot of Kings hockey in the second half, so I could not have gotten myself there. I do understand your sentiment, but man,
Yes.
it seems very one-sided right now. Okay, let's plug some stuff. What's your coverage going to be like this postseason? Both the Stars stuff, but also just in general.
Yeah, so we're doing some stuff for EP Ringside. I'm doing a kind of a weekday kind of quick daily briefing over for us over at EP Ringside. First two were up already yesterday on Monday and Tuesday. That'll be each weekday. Check that stuff out at EP Ringside. Over at the Substack over at ShapShotsHockey.com, I've got some more specific Stars stuff. I had something from the game last night. We'll keep doing that. And and then I also want to give a shout out to my good one of the other people I do some work for is the folks down at D Magazine. So if you're looking for some additional Dallas stuff, they hire me to do some extra stuff during the playoffs. And last night, me and my buddy David Castillo kind of combined a little bit for some stuff from that one as well. So a lot of playoff stuff, lots of coffee, as I've mentioned on Twitter, half jokingly, half true. If you own a coffee company, hit me up. I will plug your stuff because I'll use the product. Yeah, look at me just calling, looking. It's always be
Looking
selling,
for
man, right?
coffee sponsorships. I love
Yeah,
it.
yes, always be selling.
All right, buddy. Well, keep up the great work. We'll have you on again soon. My plug is get into the PDOcast Discord. I mentioned it earlier. I'm going to keep talking about it because it was fun in the regular season. These first few nights of the playoffs, though, it's been absolutely bustling. It just enhances your viewing experience so much getting to just comment on this stuff real time without any bots commenting on everything back and just getting to chat with similarly deranged individuals like you and I who just get to chat about this
Yes,
stuff as it's happening. So it's really fun. And the round one is, as I said, the absolute best. You know, it doesn't
it's
have the
what,
state it doesn't have quite the stakes as like when you get later,
yeah.
but the volume of games every night and also the fact that teams are theoretically like healthier and like the toll and the rigors of the playoffs haven't taken over yet and really kind of like hampered players physically, I think makes for just awesome hockey. So this is a blast, and it's the best way to enjoy it, I think.
It's what Twitter used to be. It's really what it is, right? Like in the early days of Twitter, before we always got all these mentions about nudes in bio and everything like that. It's really, I like lurking through and searching through that. I enjoy it. So
Oh, it's the best.
get in the Discord. Get into the Discord. I'll co-sign that for you.
I love that. Yeah, Sunday in particular, I was like sitting on the couch from I think 9:30 a.m. local time till 9:30 p.m. watching games. So it was fun. I feel like everyone in there are all my like loved ones, significant others, because the people in my real life don't feel that way about me right now because I'm just not available to see them because I'm just sitting on my couch watching this stuff. So I don't regret it though, because this is the best. That's all for today. We'll be back with more playoff content soon. I honestly don't have a current set schedule right now for this stuff because the Canucks are going on this playoff run for radio purposes. And so it's all up in there, but I'm just watching all these games. And so I'm going to try to, when I have takes like this, get back here and record as many shows as I can the morning after. So looking forward to that. In the meantime, enjoy another full slate of playoff games tonight. And thank you for listening to the Hockey PDOcast on the Sportsnet Radio Network.